ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Is Australia set to recognise a Palestinian state?
6 months on from the horrors of October the 7th, and with a mounting death toll, here we are.
It is a big move from Penny Wong. But what might it actually change?
Now, this is all in the realm of the organisation Human Rights Watch, and we're about to meet its new global head, who's an Australian.
And we want to ask, will anyone ever face justice over what the world is witnessing right now?
I'm Geraldine Doogue.
I'm Hamish McDonald.
And this is Global Roaming.
Well, it is an extraordinary moment, Geraldine, for us to meet this new global head of Human Rights Watch, because it comes in the wake of the killing of Zomi Frankem and those other aid workers in Gaza, as well as this speech in which Penny Wong has indicated Australia might make steps towards considering recognising a Palestinian state. So quite significant changes that I think provide us a lot to discuss.
Yes, I think the notion of having a debate kicked off, gosh, I sort of sent up a small flare of excitement when I heard that. You know, I wish a lot more things were openly debated in Australian society, and Penny Wong virtually said, this is not a done deal. I want us to think about this. I want us to debate this. And, you know, the debate will have to include the various dilemmas that are contained within. David Cameron, the British Foreign Secretary, sort of more or less kicked this off a couple of weeks back. So I think it's a very interesting moment. I think something shifted, I felt, strangely enough. I might be wrong.
What, because of the deaths of
yes,
the aid workers?
Yes. Now, some people, you know, I had friends ring me and say, my God, you know, we have seven first world people die and suddenly everything shifts. Pardon? You know, where's the justice in that? But sometimes things do shift. They turn on a dime at certain times in conflicts, and you can get change. There's leverage accorded to different groups. I think that's happening at the moment.
Well, clearly the Australian government's position has changed on the possibility of Palestinian statehood, but also the tone, tenor and substance of Anthony Albanese's language following his phone call with Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, in the wake of Zomi Frankem's death. You know, Anthony Albanese has said he's not satisfied with the response provided so far from the Israelis. They've said essentially, this is paraphrasing, that this was a mistake, but that these things happen in war. Now, there's no indication of whether those officers would face justice, which is a critical question, I think, for our conversation with Tarana Hassan today, the new boss of Human Rights Watch. Accountability. Is it possible? How is it achieved? Who faces justice? Who is justice applied to?
And is it consistent with actually finally achieving a peace that seems so elusive? It's terribly tricky.
I've been thinking about it a lot this week because, you know, so many people are drawing comparisons, right, between what's going on in Israel and Gaza today, the Palestinian territories more broadly, with Northern Ireland and the Good Friday Agreement. And we're hearing it time and time again. There is no solution here without a political solution. It can't only be a military solution. I think that argument is gaining a lot of traction. And I really cast my mind back to when I was in Gaza and going to, you know, I spent some time in the tunnels looking at all of the kind of infrastructure of this violence, but also went to a Hamas rally where a small child, a toddler, was being paraded on a stage dressed as a suicide bomber. It's an image that will never leave me, I think.
No, I can imagine.
And I reflect on it a lot at the moment because I imagine, you know, this is probably going back over 10 years now. So this toddler would be sort of teenage years, mid-teenage years now. I sort of wonder what that kid is doing today. Are they still alive? What's their attitude? How do they think about these things? And of course, this idea that every wave of violence produces another generation of people that hate. And if you think about the impact of what's unfolded in Gaza over the last 6 months, just think about where those children mentally are going to end up, psychologically, in their views of others. And so I do think this is a really salient conversation, both about justice, accountability for those that perpetrate, but also what are the circumstances and dynamics for peace?
Yes, that is the question of the moment. And as we talk to Tarana Hassan, you know, it's actually on display and not being dealt with in a whole range of parts of the world, like Sudan, for instance, where they've got people. We just can't do it all. Tragically, we cannot cope with it all.
So an incredible backstory here for Tarana Hassan. She's Australian, but a child of a Malaysian-born Sri Lankan and Chinese mother and a Pakistani father whose family had fled during partition. She was born in Singapore, grew up here in Oz, and has gone on to this quite amazing career. She's taking over the organisation now.
Here she is. Tarana Hassan, welcome.
Thanks very much for having me.
Look, Foreign Minister Penny Wong has made a pretty huge announcement in Australia this week that the federal government is contemplating recognising Palestinian statehood. Now, would that actually have an impact if that did occur?
I think that the Foreign Minister's statement is a welcome one, and it sends a message that the rights of Palestinian people do need to be recognised. And at this particular juncture in time, I mean, we're a long way off talking about a two-state solution, but we do need to be thinking about sending messages to the Israeli government that the rights of the Palestinian people, including recognition of their statehood, does matter and is being considered by allies like Australia.
Because she positioned it, I thought it was a very clever statement. She said, look, actually, it's the only chance for Israelis too of long-term peace. That this actually would quell terrorism. It would stop people like Iran having agency. Much, you know, would undermine them. So it was a sort of a multi-deliverer. Can I put it like that? Now, do you see it like that? You know, from an international law perspective, somebody who specialises in it, do you see it like that?
Well, we see it as the fundamental right of the Palestinian people.
Primarily, do you?
Indeed. I mean, everything else, I think the statements that Penny Wong made are really around how to couch it in a way that might seem more acceptable from a political perspective, but that has nothing to do with what the law says. The law is very clear. And I think that if anything, this is an invitation for Australia and for Penny Wong to start making other more stronger statements to Israel about the protection of Palestinian rights, particularly in the context that we are now in with the war in Gaza.
We will come to some of that, but I do think it's worth just exploring with you what you know to be the very controversial component of what Penny Wong has said, and she's obviously not alone in sort of edging towards these positions. We are only 6 months on from what happened on October the 7th. There are still Israeli hostages being held by Hamas and possibly other groups in Gaza. It's clear that Hamas, maybe even its backers, goal in part was to reactivate a global conversation about Palestinian statehood. Doesn't this show terror works?
No, I don't think so at all. I think that all you're seeing is that countries like Australia are beginning to catch up. I mean, these are all things that have been on the table. They're all issues that have been on the table for a very long time. Just because we're hearing this from Australia for the first time, it is something that is welcome, but it isn't new.
But triggered by what happened on October 7th and everything that's happened since.
I think it's more that people have seen, you know, it's being streamed into your lounge room now, the sort of discrimination that exists on a daily basis for the Palestinian people, whether that be in the West Bank or whether that be in Gaza. So, you know, we are at a point where the situation in Israel and Palestine has become untenable, and it's resulting in the loss of thousands of lives because of this conflict. You know, this is not a reaction, or these are not statements that come because of what Hamas did. If anything, what Hamas did on October 7th is something that has been condemned internationally very clearly. These were crimes under international law. When you start killing civilians, these are war crimes.
This is Hamas you're talking
this
about.
This is about Hamas. And Australia has been very clear in condemning those crimes. Actually, they were very clear, and they've been slower to condemn the Israeli Defence Forces crimes and violations of international law. But they're getting there now, and we are beginning to see progress and a clear recognition that there needs to be a vision and articulation of what is going to happen when this war ends, and looking for durable solutions.
I suppose it's a case of language and how you couch these things. For instance, you've accused Israel of using starvation as a weapon of war. Are you using similar language about Hamas? For instance, embedding weapons centres under hospitals. That's what people are saying to human rights organisations. Now, hang on, there's got to be an equivalence in the way you talk.
Absolutely. I mean,
do you take that on as a critique at all?
Well, I think it's really important to go back and have a look at what human rights organisations like Human Rights Watch are saying. For Human Rights Watch, we have been very clear that the violations that took place, the attacks on October 7th, were inexcusable. They were the killings of civilians, hundreds of civilians, unarmed, and those are violations of international law. Those are war crimes, as is this taking of hostages. And Human Rights Watch has been very explicit about this, and we've issued statements and research findings to that
effect.
You're
exploring that, are you, on an ongoing basis?
Oh, yes. You can see from the work that we've put out that's on our website that we've released multiple statements and research documents which look at the violations of international law that have taken place by Hamas and other armed Palestinian groups. We've also condemned the firing of rockets from Gaza into civilian areas in Israel. But that doesn't, this isn't a tit for tat, you know. Violations of international law by one side or atrocities that have been committed by one side don't excuse atrocities being committed
by
another.
No, it's purely the way the language comes out. I couldn't agree with you more. But it's the sound and the tone of what emanates from organisations like yours.
Yes, and I think everywhere that we operate in the world, we cover conflicts all over the world and we don't take sides. Our role in an armed conflict, no matter where it is to document violations of international law, and the primary centre of why we do what we do is to protect civilians. And that is the premise of international humanitarian law. It's not that we're arguing that, you know, everybody should stop fighting. We don't opine on the justness of war. Our job is to actually look closely at the conduct of the warring parties. And where there are violations of international law, we must bring those to light. Bring that evidence and those facts to the surface, and that's what you find at the core of Human Rights Watch reports and press releases, because that's what leads to accountability, and accountability matters.
I want to pick up on one of those reports, because Human Rights Watch has accused Israel of using starvation as a weapon of war in relation to Gaza. Israel, of course, denies those allegations. What's the actual evidence that Israel is deliberately doing this, and that it is Israel and there's no other parties involved in that?
So starvation and weapon of war is a violation under international humanitarian law, as well as under the Rome Statute. That's the statute for the International Criminal Court. And, you know, Human Rights Watch research has been very clear. We have seen since October the 7th, there has been a closing of the border crossings, which has limited access to humanitarian aid. And that is life-saving humanitarian assistance.
And that's just Israel doing that? Because obviously there's this whole issue of what comes in through Egypt, the delays and holdups there. Is it just Israel that's responsible for this?
The border crossings are controlled by Israel, and it is the Israeli government that controls what aid can go in to Gaza. So what we've seen since October 7th is the closing of the border crossings that were used to bring in life-saving assistance for 16 years. Mm. 300 trucks were coming in a day. It has now moved to an absolute trickle. And there have been, it's not just food. It's also been fuel, it's been water, and it's been life-saving medical assistance. But particularly on the starvation point, I just want to come back. It's not only the restrictions to the food delivery and the food aid being brought into Gaza, we've also documented through the use of satellite imagery that farmland in the north of Gaza has been destroyed after the Israeli forces went into northern Gaza. And that means that, you know, it's really destroying Gazans' abilities to actually farm their own food and the land that they use to survive on.
The aid flow, though, in terms of trucks, it's gone up slightly, obviously, since the killing
about
of those.
About 120 now a day, I think, isn't it?
It changes.
300 trucks, I think, earlier this week.
So the issue is that, you know, when we get into counting trucks on that are coming in per week, we're already well below thinking about meeting the nutritional requirements of an average person. You know, this is not, even the UN has been very clear.
But just to pick up on that, though, obviously the Israeli argument on this stuff tends to be, look, we've got to make sure that what's coming in is safe, that it's not weapons, that it's not things that can be used to make weapons, that, you know, they're clearly absolutely determined to ensure that Hamas cannot do what it did.
Those two things aren't incompatible, Hamish. You can easily, and it is their right to be able to check the trucks that are going into Gaza to be able to make sure that they are humanitarian aid. But I think it's really important that we don't lose the distinction that there have been a lot of excuses that have been made and allegations that have been made that there's a diversion of aid and these sort of things. And they really have not been justified. And ultimately, we are seeing the consequences now of what is happening through these restrictions.
You say that human rights law and practice is all about accountability. In this context, do you see Netanyahu or the Hamas leaders, Yahya Sinwar or Ismail Haniyeh, or whoever was responsible for the aid workers like Zomi Frankem's death, do you see them in the dock actually facing justice?
Well, I mean, what we do know is that justice does take a long time, but perpetrators of violations of international law, of war crimes, do end up in the dock. We've seen it before.
But come on, I mean, you don't honestly sit here and say you can picture Netanyahu or Yahya Sinwar in a courtroom in The Hague.
I don't think people would have said that about Milosevic either, once upon a time, but it did happen. And I think it's not necessarily about Netanyahu. The onus is that if there are violations of international law, that we must conduct investigations, and the International Criminal Court has an open investigation that is open, that actually the prosecutor has said that they will look at violations that have happened since October 7th.
But your organisation is saying that they are happening. Who's committing them in your mind?
Well, we've documented violations of and war crimes by both Palestinian armed groups and the Israeli Defence Force. And so then it gets to the point of, when you think about accountability, we need to talk about the chain of command. And these are issues that Human Rights Watch is consistently looking at. And that's what leads to, you know, who it is exactly that should be held to account.
See, I mean, it's interesting. Do you think of, for instance, slightly removed groups like Iran? Or Qatar at the moment it plays host to the political wing of Hamas. Now, do you think of UREMIT extending beyond the immediate combatants or not?
So when it comes to actually looking at influencing the conduct of the warring parties on the battlefield, we often do send our reports and messages and make recommendations to the allies or the friends of the warring parties. So in this instance, you know, we have, when we're talking about stopping Palestinian armed groups, Hamas in particular, from firing rockets from Gaza into Israel.
What about Hezbollah? It's been in that category too, I suppose.
We will talk to the allies. So we will talk to Turkey, anybody that might have influence on the armed group.
But wouldn't you also be talking about the countries that are selling weapons to or giving weapons to Israel? Like the contracts of sale, don't they all dictate or stipulate that they have to be used in alignment with international law?
Yes. So I was just about to move on to Israel, actually. So yes, when it comes to Israel, we're talking about countries like Australia and like the United States
Germany. Weapons, are we?
No, not selling weapons, but you're talking about, you know, allies and people that have influence over the Israeli authorities. Now, when it comes to weapon sales, you're 100% right. Our call to the United States has been that if you know that there is a good chance that the weapons that you are selling or giving in military assistance to the Israeli Defense Force will be used in the commission of violations of international law or human rights abuses, then the domestic law in the United States says that you should not be selling those weapons and you should stop military assistance. So this is not about us saying that the US has to take some sort of an extraordinary step. We're saying you should be compliant with your domestic legal obligations.
Look, I wonder about what's... You've talked about transactional diplomacy. Now, if we want to get out of this terrible mess, there'll have to be good diplomatic work. Well, there is now behind the scenes, working their insides out, trying to get a peace. What do you mean? Because you criticise transactional diplomacy. What's the matter with it if it actually yields the goods?
So, well, the problem is that transactional diplomacy has done the exact opposite of yielding the goods. What it's actually done is... What we're seeing happen is governments are actually putting aside their human rights obligations for the very short-term political gains. So one of the things I'd say, Geraldine, is that when we're talking about the US not selling weapons, that's not transactional diplomacy.
No, that's a separate thing.
Right, that's something separate. That's actually the US being compliant with their own domestic legal obligations, which is to ensure that they're not facilitating the commission of human rights abuses. But transactional diplomacy, as we've seen it, is places like, you think about Biden, who had said that after the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, the journalist who was killed in the Saudi embassy in Turkey. We heard very strong statements from governments all over the world, right, about we're going to make Saudi Arabia and Mohammed bin Salman the pariahs of the international world. Then Ukraine happens and the US becomes a little bit nervous about what's going to happen with their oil supplies. And all of a sudden we have photographs of Mohammed bin Salman and Joe Biden with fist bumps.
But see, he might be critical to actually gaining peace in this region. This is the tricky part of it, isn't it? It's very difficult to be pure on
this. But that had nothing to do with the other. That had to do with making sure that you were getting oil and natural resources to shore up a sensitive moment after the full-scale invasion of Russia in Ukraine. So this was a very different situation. And we've seen this all over the world.
It sort of goes to the point of transactionalism, though, doesn't it? That suddenly players become more important as events arise, right? And Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, is suddenly not just a key player as far as global energy market is concerned in the Russia-Ukraine context, but it's also central potentially to any solution vis-a-vis Israel and Hamas or Gaza, because obviously Israel does want normalized ties with Saudi.
Absolutely. But the thing about turning a blind eye to domestic human rights abuses in Saudi Arabia or elsewhere is that you're essentially then creating a culture of impunity.
Mm. And but he's building that big new shiny city in the desert. I mean, isn't that distracting enough?
Distracting is, yes.
Hamish.
I think that I think distraction is the problem, Hamish. What we're calling for is for states to actually sit down and actually think, remember,
but
a really important thing.
But hold on.
These are not... We are talking about law. Human rights is not a buffet where you wander around and go, I'll have a little bit of this and I'm gonna skip the torture today. That can go on.
I get it, but the world is starting to do that, for example, with Afghanistan, right? This brutal Taliban regime that the West went to war to remove after 9/11, 20-plus years of conflict, they're back. And now the international community is again starting to work with them because a view is being taken that, well, we don't like what they do to women, that we don't like what they're doing to the Hazaras, but look, this is a bit easier than nonstop insurgency and warfare.
Well, I think that we're still seeing at least some semblance of moral courage and adherence to international human rights from the international community when it comes to the Taliban. Mm.
Even in the aid community that say, look, you just have to work with these guys because they're in charge now.
I mean, humanitarian actors are... trying to work in Afghanistan. As somebody who spent, a good well over a decade in the humanitarian aid world, you are neutral as a humanitarian actor. You talk to all parties in a war zone or a conflict, so that you can get to the civilian population. So let's put the humanitarians aside for a second, because what we're talking about here is the normalization and acceptance of the Taliban regime into the international community. And we
I'm not defending it, but I'm observing what's there.
I'm very glad to hear that. it would have made for a very interesting discussion if you were.
But they are in charge of that state now. I mean, this is so difficult to manage.
And I think that if you have
awful people become in charge of states, and you can't let the best be the enemy of the good, a lot of people would argue, and you've got to learn to work with them.
Let's take a step back for a sec, because I think you've said something that's really important, and that is that they are running the country. Now, if you want to be a legitimate body that is running a country, then you also have to take into account the rules by which the world expects you to operate, including not being a human rights abusing state. And so for the Taliban to want to come in and be welcomed into the fold, then they need to actually address the grave human rights abuses that are happening inside Afghanistan. That doesn't just mean
like girls' education.
That's right. Girls' education is one, but there's a whole remit of human rights abuses being committed by the Taliban, from torture to even boys' schooling to the fact that a significant portion of the country is actually about to, you know, enter into famine. There aren't basic services such as hospitals. But don't fall under the illusion that the Taliban is, you know, impermeable. Because they want to be. That is the carrot. They want to be seen as a legitimate actor. And Human Rights Watch has just finished a report where we documented the failure of the Taliban to deliver a functioning health system to its people, particularly to women, because they've banned women from working. And we have now seen 10 institutions who have been willing to open up and actually accept women into these medical colleges.
What, since your report's come out?
Indeed.
Oh, really? Look, well, maybe that's a perfect segue for us, because, you know, you're a very interesting person to read about, because you started off in social work and had quite a career, and then you went back and did the law. I mean, I feel like asking you, why didn't you stay in, say, the delivery of aid rather than go into international law? Because they're very different entities, I think.
So I had a very rich career working in international aid, and one day I was working in Sudan in Darfur. I remember the exact moment that I decided
that's something we should talk about too, Sudan.
Yes, I would welcome that. But I remember I was there at the beginning of the genocide in Sudan, and we had sort of reached one of our clinics. I was working on child protection and working with women who had survived sexual violence, and it was being perpetrated by the Janjaweed, which was an Arab militia group. And I remember it was dawn and we were seeing a new offensive that was just about to be launched, and we were told it was too dangerous for us to continue driving to the location we were. So we turned around and I said, well, let's stop at our health clinic on the way just to check if everything's there. And when we got there, there were people all over the compound, and it was well before we were meant to open. And a woman walked up to me and gave me a small infant. And my reflex was to hold my hands out, and she left this child in my hands. It was tiny. And a woman came up and translated for me, and she said, this woman has just said that their village had been attacked. The village's name was Labado. And she described in detail how, first of all, the men on camels and horses came in and shot at them, and then they were followed by Sudanese army, you know, in cars. And she said, I have four children to take care of. And as we were running, this baby's mother, my neighbor, was shot. She fell, so I picked up the baby and I kept on running. But I have to look after my own children. You take it. And I remember somebody came out of nowhere and the baby had started crying, and the woman took her and breastfed her. And I remember just thinking to myself, in this moment of inhumanity, there is such humanity. I also remember thinking, somebody has to pay for this. Somebody needs to be accountable for this child's mother being killed. And so I went back and I started, I did my master's in international human rights law, and no regrets.
You say no regrets, but I mean, we just established that we'd run into each other in Bangkok, I think, during some of the big protests there. Your career really has just been sort of bouncing from one horror show to another. I mean, I've done it as a foreign correspondent, ended up incredibly burnt out and, you know, pretty raw from the whole thing. What's the driver for you? Because I, you know, I've read your, also your personal family story. Is that, how does that inform what you've ended up doing?
So, you know, my father was a child in born in India, and then during the partition, when the creation of Pakistan, when a lot of Muslims left the Punjab and went into Pakistan, my dad and his family were one of those. And I distinctly remember my dad telling me the story of, you know, how their family left within just minutes, because my grandfather had apparently been warned that there was an angry mob coming and looking for Muslims. And my dad didn't talk about it on a daily basis. It was just something that shaped his life. And he talked a little bit about the experience of displacement. There were things that he used to do, like he used to eat an orange two segments at a time. And we were always like, why do you do that? And he said, I remember what it was like to feel hungry. Wow. During their journey. And he said he was a young boy, but he just remembered that feeling of feeling hungry and always being scared of that feeling again. And then my father wrote a book. I was born in Singapore. My father was an academic. He was a sociologist who wrote a book criticizing Lee Kuan Yew's housing policy, essentially. And, you know, Lee Kuan Yew was, you know, people have rewritten history. They like to remember him as the, you know, the father of Singapore, who made Singapore the pearl of Asia. He was also somebody that squashed any sort of criticism, all under the guise back in the 70s of it being part of a Marxist conspiracy. But that's how you silence journalists and silence political opposition, and eventually tried to silence academics. So my family left and we ended up in Adelaide. All of that informs me in ways of I am aware of how vulnerable people can be and what it is like to stand up to power and the human consequences of that. And we were always, you know, we grew up with a really strong sense that, you know, we aren't passive participants in this world, that we all have a contribution to make. And I think that actually it's best summed up for me like this. I remember, do you remember the Tampa, obviously?
Yeah. Certainly.
The Tampa incident. I remember sitting at a legal seminar once listening to one of the lawyers who took on the Tampa case. And he said, you know, when I went to bed that night and I saw what was happening on the Tampa, I thought to myself, this is terrible. Somebody has to do something about it. Mm. And he went to bed thinking, surely Amnesty or Human Rights Watch, one of these groups, will do something. And he woke up the next morning and he said, but what if they don't? And I think that that's really how I feel about, you know, whether it's watching the news and seeing the reports of foreign correspondents or seeing what's happened in the world or even hearing a racist comment on a bus, you have two choices, right? You can either just pretend you didn't see it or just absorb it and let it go, or you could choose to do something about it. I choose to do something about it through documentation, through advocacy, through trying to deal with things at a policy and a legal level. But I think there are ways that all of us can do something about it. It's even just being aware. It's making sure that these people and their stories and the wrongs in the world don't go unnoticed.
But just to stay on that example, though, I mean, I've kept in touch with the Tampa boys, the unaccompanied minors that were on that boat for many years.
Yeah.
They ended up in New Zealand. It's been a very complicated story for them, really complicated. It's not like they ever really came, in my mind, ever really came ashore. You know, their lives have been sort of adrift in many ways, some success stories, but really adrift. And that moment, that Tampa moment, has shaped so much of Australia's politics since, refugee and migrant politics here and around the world. Do you think we've got it right? Do you think the answers... Because the world is so unstable, there's always going to be this desire to go to countries like Australia, and we just know that's democracies are not going to keep allowing that, are they?
I think we need to step away from the narrative that is peddled that there is some sort of dangerous influx of, you know, countless people who are trying to bang on the borders and the doors. I mean, just not true.
But you know the politics of this, right? Whether it's here in Australia or America or Europe, those narratives, if you want to say it's just a narrative, they exist.
They exist and they should be challenged.
But they challenge the democracy too.
Well, I think one of the things that we have seen when you talk about backsliding of democracy and sort of the erosion of human rights is there are two canary in the coal mines that we've begun to see all over the world, which are early indicators that human rights are in peril. One is the family values narrative. So the first thing you'll hear from sort of populist and sort of anti-rights leaders is, oh, to protect family values, you know, we should be cracking down on LGBT rights, or you need to be careful about what is educated in school on gender identity, or we should really take a harder stance on women's reproductive rights, essentially limiting the right to abortion access and medical care. And that is dangerous because if we let that happen, the other big narrative that is peddled by these sort of autocratic or, you know, anti-rights leaders is security. And when they talk about security, what you generally see is let's crack down on critics, let's create a fear-mongering narrative about migrants, refugees, it's the othering of people. And if we allow that to happen, then we're on that slippery slope where they start to go for the institutions. The attacks on journalists and critics, the attacks on dissenting voices and political parties. And the attacks on institutions like courts.
But that's
that
what people like Trump here, who are given
right.
a real leg. Yes, but because of the uncontained flow of migrants across that border, starts to give all sorts of malign influences much more power than they otherwise would have. That's precisely the point that really smart political operators say, be careful what you wish for, you know?
Dangerous political operators, Geraldine. These are people who are peddling dangerous narratives. We have to remember that there's migration and then there's seeking asylum. When it came to Australia, Australia just disregarded all of its international obligations in relation to the Refugee Convention. When we talk about migration, if we want to talk about how do we get orderly migration, how do we begin to have, you know, proper systems in place, then we're talking about safe and legal routes so people don't have to resort to doing dangerous crossings across the Darien Gap when it comes to the southern border of the United States. We need to be investing in, or states need to be investing in, solutions which involve safe and legal routes where people can be assessed. The danger is, and where this all goes pear-shaped, frankly, is when we start believing and legitimizing the fear-mongering and the tactics, because it's not just about what it's going to do to refugees and asylum seekers, it's what it does to our societies. It actually creates a narrative and a feeling and a lived experience of othering. You begin to other migrant populations, you begin to other, you know, anyone who's different that these political leaders then want to make a target to make themselves look better. You know, it's the old framing of how do you come across as a strong man that everyone believes they need. But what is underneath that strong man narrative is actually leaders who want to cast human rights aside, who have zero regard for their people and actually are just trying to get rid of the checks and balances that are required to create and sustain open, democratic and rights-abiding societies.
You've taken on this huge role running Human Rights Watch at a really interesting time, troubling time globally. So some big challenges. Obviously, there's also been some issues at Human Rights Watch. You know, there's been some criticism from people who have worked there previously about bias, particularly on Israel-Palestine. What do you want to do with Human Rights Watch? I mean, you're obviously very ambitious with your ideas. What will be success for you?
I mean, success when it comes to our work is ensuring that we are able to document abuses and we are able to put that information into the hands of those that actually have the power to do something about it. That is what we have done for decades and that is what we need to continue to do. And it's even more important now because we live in a world where the facts are essentially up for debate. You know, where criticism is cast aside, or when we provide the facts about human rights abuses, they're cast aside as, you know, fake news. And it's with our meticulous fact-finding and actually bringing the use of things like new technology to make sure that we're able to put together such comprehensive, irrefutable evidence that actually pushes through, cuts through the noise. So, you know, think of it this way. You know, once upon a time you'd speak to one witness. Now everybody has a mobile phone, a supercomputer in their pocket. And with that comes the power to get 20, 50, 100 more pieces of evidence for us to actually make the case and ensure that we can drill down and ensure accountability.
And I just, Tim Costello, you know, very well-known commentator here, said something really profound, I think, the other day, just reminding us that in this sort of a climate, we can ignore the fact that humans can simultaneously be victims and perpetrators, especially at times like we're seeing. Now, that again, how do you sort through that for human rights purposes?
You know, for us, we look at an incident and we go to the facts. And then you take those facts and you apply international law. And it doesn't matter. We are not there to opine on who's a good guy and who's a bad guy. All we do is we put the facts out there and we remind the world who is committing abuses. And sometimes, I think more often in the world, maybe this is what Tim Costello was talking about, is that we find that people who may be champions for human rights abuses, let's say on climate change, might be committing human rights abuses when it comes to things like torture. You've hit on something very important, Geraldine. There's no kind of, you know, once upon a time people used to say, oh, there's a global policeman, right? And they used to look to the United States. That is just not the case anymore. We are seeing that, you know, countries all over the world are faltering on their human rights obligations, but also we are seeing new actors coming up who are prepared to be new champions on human rights and protecting rights violations in countries abroad. So I actually think that at this point in time, the world is shifting. There are tectonic shifts in how power is being played out in the world. But actually, as overwhelming as that is in some instances, it is also providing new opportunities for potential allyship and actually new champions for human rights and the protection of the world order.
Tarana Hassan, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. Thank you for entertaining all of our questions and challenges.
Appreciate your time. Thanks for having me on.
Well, Hamish, in terms of reflections, I have to say, I don't think that the end of wars necessarily involve perfect justice. I think that's utopian. That was, I understand why Tarana said it, but it's funny, it's not my sense of a prerequisite for a new stage of life for people whom you're desperate to get beyond the shooting.
Well, that's exactly what the world must grapple with now. If there is to be a pathway forward out of this current conflict and many of the conflicts, what does it look like? What's the path to peace? What's the political solution and who does that involve? Whether we're talking about the Taliban or Hamas or other organisations, the Janjaweed militia in Sudan, there are real sacrifices, I think, that end up
trade-offs.
Being made.
There are trade-offs, I think, that have to be made. But I know that people who work in the law, international law, they never agree with this. I've had very vigorous arguments. They will not sign up to that. Well, you know, I say good luck to them, but I think you've got to.
So, recommendation, Jerry?
One, another SBS On Demand documentary, historical documentary. You can see sort of a pattern here. I like looking at things that provide me with history in order to prepare me for the present. A very nice four-part series from Canadian documentary makers called The Cold War of Spies, just showing this amazing, I mean, it's not Le Carré, it's far more than that, but how those people were deployed and how various governments, Soviet and Americans, deployed individuals to affect the course of events and to produce the world we've got now.
Speaking of patterns, that was four episodes, wasn't it? You're unbelievable. My recommendation this week from the FT, Financial Times, they've done this extraordinary piece of work. It's one of those kind of graphic visualizations of a piece of journalism. They've tracked a sack of rice that was supposed to be delivered to Gaza as part of a humanitarian aid package. They've tracked its journey over time, arriving at an Egyptian port until it got all the way to Gaza to see what the holdups are.
The complexity.
Yes, absolutely extraordinary. It's sort of journey through Egypt, then the crossings. It's really worth a look. It's very illuminating as you're trying to understand some of these issues. Now, Jerry, some very exciting news for next week. Who have we got?
Anthony Scaramucci, who otherwise known as The Mooch, who people might remember from his 11 memorable days as the director of President Donald Trump's communications unit, sacked at the end of 11 days, dragged through the mud, and now very anti-Trump.
I cannot wait to speak to him. Hey, thanks for your company this week. Please give us a star rating, a like, a follow, a comment, wherever you're listening. Of course, you can find us on the ABC Listen app. global.roaming@abc.net.au is our email address, and you can find that on the notes of the episode page. Thanks to our wonderful producer, Taryn Priyadko. Jerry, see you next time.
Bye-bye, Amy.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.